GNSO RPM's PDP Working Group, Part 4, starting at 8:30, ending at 10:15, Room 103A, March 14th.
Everyone on the phone, this is Kathy Kleiman, one of the co-chairs of the RPM Working Group, and we are still waiting for a number of people to join us, so it looks like we'll be starting about 5 minutes late. Apologies to everyone, but we're going to direct traffic and break up coffee breaks and bring everyone into the room. We would like to call this meeting to order in about 10 seconds.
So if we can just start the recording. We all good? Thank you. And so we can open the meeting, Kathy.
Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon, good evening for people who are participating, including people participating very, very early their time, which we appreciate. This is Kathy Kleiman, and I'm with Phil Corwin, the now two co-chairs of the Rights Protection Mechanisms Working Group. And we welcome you to our fourth out of four meetings here in San Juan. And we're happy to be here, and it's a very important session today where we're talking to the URS providers. We have Renee Fossen in person, the Director of Arbitration for the Forum, Yvette Polovics, URS Manager for MFSD, and Carrie Shang, ADR Legal Counsel for ADNDRC. Yvette and Carrie are joining us remotely. As everyone knows who's been participating for the last day, we've lost Adobe Connect, which means that the traditional way we run the meeting is not traditional anymore. People will be raising their hands physically in the room. People will be speaking remotely and letting us know when they want to participate. We will try to remember to let you know when we move to the next slide, because everyone's running their own slide decks now. And we've been urged by our wonderful AV team to make sure that we speak slowly into the microphone, directly into the microphone, if we want the people who are coming in on the phone bridge to be able to hear us. And I want to congratulate my co-chair, Phil Corwin, on his birthday today. So a round of applause for Phil, who always dedicates his birthday to us.
I'm happy to celebrate my birthday, given the alternative.
And Phil, that's it for my opening remarks. I thought you might have one or two.
Yeah, I'll be brief. We're all happy that this is our final morning of work in beautiful San Juan. Thank everyone for being here when it's such a lovely day out. We thank the providers for being with us and to present today and take initial questions. I'm co-chairing the sub-team on providers, and we're preparing, I think they're aware, we're providing a more formal list of objective questions about how they handle various aspects of the rules, the MOU, and the procedures set out for URS providers, and we anticipate wrapping up that exercise and getting those questions out in the next few weeks. But so some of those questions may repeat queries that come from the audience today, but that's fine. We'll get it on the record here today and then more formally with those written questions. Just let me ask staff, do we know who's called in, or do we need to ask who's on the line?
This is Erin from staff. We have, besides Yvette and Carrie, we have two other remote participants. One is Diana Ardondo, and the other is George Kirikos.
Okay, so that answers that question. So I'll be quiet and let our guest proceed with the presentation, and we'll look forward to a productive and informative session. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Renee Fossen for the Forum. I think Kathy may have covered this a little bit in her introductory remarks, that we are going to take the categories or the topics that were provided to us as providers, and we'll take them one at a time. So I'll start with as Forum, and then Yvette will provide her input, and then Carrie will also provide hers, and then we'll stop for questions on that particular topic. I think it'll be easier to keep track of where we're at in the conversation. doing it that way rather than waiting for questions at the end. So hopefully we can get through it. I think it's a little ambitious, but we'll get started right now. So we're going to each do some introductions about ourselves and our services. I'm Renee with Forum. I have been with Forum since September of 2016, so about a year and a half. There's our website listed on the first slide on page 3. I did want to direct the working group's attention to the URS documents that we have available on our website. There are several to look at, and the demos, I think, are particularly interesting. They go through, and it actually shows the screens that the parties would be seeing as they're filing. We do plan on doing some updates, but the probably not till the end of this year, so I would take a look at those. We won't change the content necessarily, just maybe the appearance of some of those documents on our website. So please take a look at those. I contemplated going through those today, but I just don't think that we're going to have time to get into that kind of detail at this point. Forum has been administering domain name disputes since 1999 with the UDRP and since the inception of the URS, along with some other domain name dispute resolution processes. On to slide 4. Yvette, would you like to give your introduction?
Yes, thank you. Hi, Renee, and hi, everyone in the room. I'm happy to be here today, also if I'm presenting remotely. Let's start with a little introduction about MFSD. At our online dispute management platform, there is a description of the new GTLD program and the URS. Also the rules, the fees, the examiners, and the determinations are published. And in order to file any form, so complaint, response, appeal, or response to appeal, or other communications, it is necessary to register at our platform to have access to such online forms. Our dispute resolution center is specialized in the resolution of intellectual property disputes. We are based in Milan, and we were established in 2000. Since 2001, we are authorized to handle the .it domain name disputes. Since 2012 and 2013, we also have services for IP mediation and training. And since 2015, the end of 2015, we are URS provider as well. Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to slide 5 with Carrie.
Hi, this is Carrie Sheng. I am the ADR Legal Counsel of Hong Kong International Arbitration Center. I'm overseeing our domain name dispute resolution services and other IP-related services, including mediation. So I would like to direct everyone to our website if you have the liberty to access the internet from your end. You're going to see that actually the Asian Dispute Asian Domain Name Dispute Resolution Center, ADNDRC, unlike the forum or MFC, is actually a collaboration scheme that's by four different organizations. So we have CTAC, the China International Economic and Trade Arbitration Commission, Hong Kong IAC, the Hong Kong International Arbitration Center. We also have IDRC based in Seoul and the Asian International Arbitration Center based in KL, Malaysia. So basically, this is a joint effort. It's a joint platform by four different offices. It was established in 2002, meaning that ADNDRC is, I guess, the youngest center among the three of us, and then we were joined by the Seoul office and KL office in 2006 and 2009, respectively. we are able to administer a wide range of domain name dispute resolution proceedings under the UDRP, URS, PM, PDDRP, PDRP, SDRP, and CEDRP. So basically, when any complainant would like to file a complaint to the ADNDRC in whatever proceeding, the complainant shall have the right to select one of the four offices to ask the dispute resolution provider. Unfortunately or unfortunately for URS proceeding, parties have only chosen the Hong Kong office, meaning the Hong Kong International Arbitration Center, to administer the cases. So all 33 cases that are decided by the ADNDRC are actually administered by the Hong Kong Center of the ADNDRC. So that finished my introduction. Next slide.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to slide 6, entitled Communications. This is a slide, we'll have one for each of the categories where we have just a brief summary of the what we were asked to talk about and a brief summary answer. So communications with the parties to a URS proceeding and communications with registries and registrars throughout the duration of the URS proceeding. Forum, I'm going to just go down to slide 7 now, just to jump right into it. Forum corresponds with the registry with the information that's available from ICANN via email, and they send the complaint requesting a verification and a lock. A correspondence with the respondent at the commencement of a case is an email containing the notice, translated if necessary per Rule 9, complaint, and a link to the online portal for filing a response. We'll only accept responses if they're filed on our portal. The notice is sent by fax and regular mail. The registrar, we correspond with them via email, and that comes after with an email sent attaching the notice, translated if necessary, and the complaint. If there's a privacy shield, some registrars will provide a will provide respondent information, and if we are able to obtain more information, then we do also send that information along we send the notice and the complaint along to the new contact information that we may get. Not all registrars will do that, but if they do, we take advantage of that. The complainant, all correspondence is by email. Of course, we'll accept phone calls from any parties in the process to answer procedural questions if necessary. There's a case coordinator assigned to each case, and that coordinator will reply either via email with the answer to your question, or they will give you a phone call. I think to address Maxim's question from Saturday, I think it was, about why the registry doesn't get the notice at the time, the same information that the registrar gets at the time, it's because the case hasn't commenced yet. So we don't really have a notice generated until after the case is commenced. So that's why the registry doesn't receive that information. Yvette, we'll go back up to slide 6 then.
Thank you. With the parties, the communications of MFSAD is usually by email. Regarding the complainant, it's by email to the email address provided in the complaint. So it can be the complainant itself or the authorized representative of the complainant. With the respondent, all communications different from the notice of complaint and the notice of default are sent by email. Notice of complaint and notice of default are sent by email, by courier, and by fax if there is any fax number available in the WHOIS data to all addresses shown in the WHOIS confirmed by the registry and to any email addresses provided by the complainant in the complaint. The communications to the respondent are sent in English and are translated with the translation also. And with the notice of complaint, we also send the form of the response in the language of the respondent. With the registries and the registrars, all communications are by email to the email addresses that are made available by ICANN. If there is any privacy question, if the registry with the notice of lock provides any additional contact information for the respondent, such information will be included in the notice of complaint. So there could be also an additional address for the respondent if it is made available by the registry operator. Thank you.
We'll go back up to slide 6 and Carrie, and then we'll just go down to slide 9.
Sure. Thanks, Jenny. I guess the simple way to answer this question is that ADN ERC, everything is conducted electronically, unlike the forum or MSD. We do not provide queries with courier or fax or other types of postal mail. Everything is in email. We do have a online portal so that when the complainant has made any submission, if any communication from the center needs to be transmitted to the party, then on the online portal there's a way for our case managers to access the information and press the send button so that the complainant is going to receive the notice in that way. But nothing is generated automatically. Case manager would have to actually operate that particular port for email to be sent. Also for communications with registries and registrars throughout the duration of your as proceeding on all communication from the center and registries or registrars or conducted in email and in English. We do not provide any additional translation in our communication with parties or registrars.
Thank you, Carrie. Moving on to, well, we have time for questions. Yes.
I'm going to start the queue. Phil Corwin and anyone else, please raise your hand. This is a question for the Asian Dispute Domain Name Dispute Resolution Center for Carrie. The URS rules say that under communications that the provider it has a responsibility to employ reasonably available means calculated to achieve actual notice to the respondent, and that achieving actual notice or employing the following measures to do so shall discharge this responsibility, and that's by sending notice to the complaint to all email, postmail, and facsimile addresses shown in the domain name's registration data or the WHOIS database, and also to the technical contact and the administrative contact. So I have a two-part question. One, do you feel you're complying with that rule by employing only email? And secondly, if you receive notice that the email has not gone through, do you follow up by other means to try to assure that the respondent gets actual notice in sufficient time to be able to prepare a response if they wish to do so? The main question is, since the other two providers are employing all those means and you're using only email, do you feel that you're in compliance with the rules?
Thanks for the question. So we have basically promulgated the supplemental rules and under Article 3 of the supplemental rules. We were basically drafters of supplemental rules in order to implement the URS procedure has, read under rule in a way that everything shall be made electronically via the internet in accordance with the guidelines for U.S. submission. I think the system has been designed in a way that makes sure, that has ensured the compliance. But I would like to raise additional matter by saying that we do have this kind of procedure if there is a proxy service. If we found that a proxy has used particular respondent so that there's a possibility that the sender might not be able to identify the true identity of the respondent. In that particular case, then the relevant office of sender is going to request the registry operator to identify the respondent, notifying the registry operator of the complaint. So that is additional safeguard that we do in instances when the privacy or proxy service is involved. Again, we have not received any complaint regarding not receiving notice. So I personally feel that we have been complied with the URS requirements, although we have not implemented additional procedure to try to notify the respondent via fax or courier services.
Okay, thank you for that. And as mentioned, there'll be very detailed written questions coming to all the providers in regard to communications and our other practices. Are there other folks in the room or online who have a question regarding communications before we move on to the next section? Kathy?
If no one else does. Okay. Ariel, go ahead.
This is Ariel Lam for the record. There's a remote question from Justin Chu. With respect to slide 7, Renee mentioned that in the case where there is a privacy shield, some registrars will provide respondent information. What happens if a registrar does not provide respondent information? What do MFSD and ADNDRC in similar circumstances?
This is Renee. I'll go first. If we don't receive that additional information from the registrar, which is not typical that we would receive information from them because the case moves so quickly, we just proceed with the information that we have. That's really all that we can do. Yvette?
Yes. Since the notice of lock is sent to the registry operator and the registrar is copied, usually it's the registry operator that responds. And if there is any privacy shield, the registry doesn't have the information available for them. It's only the registrar who has the underlying information regarding the registrant. And if registrar is not communicating any information, we just proceed as forum said, using the information that is available in WHIS.
This is Ariel for the record. Actually, we do have another question from George Kirikos, but perhaps we can do that question later because it's not on the exact point we're talking about, and I will forward that to the three providers as well.
This is Kathy Kleiman. I have a question about translations and how you know what the language of the registration agreement is, how you find that out, and so how you know to whom you have to send a translated notice. Thank you.
Actually, Renee will start. This is Renee with Forum. With respect to translations, it's not the registry agreement doesn't govern what language it is. It's the physical location of the respondent. So we have a whatever is in the WHOIS information or the information that we're able to get from the registrar, we use that information and research whatever country it may be or region, province, to see what the dominant language is in that province or country or area. And we if we don't already have the translations, we prepare those very quickly and get them sent in the appropriate language.
Thank you. May I ask Yvette and Carrie also about translations?
Yes, sure. It's Yvette. As Renee said, the language of the proceeding is not as in the UDRP governed by the language of the registration agreement in the URS. So the language is usually the predominant language of the registrant country. So we do the translation in that language. We do the translation of all email communications, the notice of complaint, the notice of default, and we also provide a response form in such language to the respondent. Thank you.
Thank you. Carrie.
I would like to echo what Yvette and Renee mentioned, that the language of registry document in URS proceeding is not as important as it is in UDRP proceeding. At times, we do have inquiries from, especially from the respondent side, regarding language of the proceedings. As I mentioned in the initial introduction, we do not have a formal procedure of translating documents into their language, translating documents or communications to corresponding languages. But our case administrators are usually happy to answer questions parties might have sometimes, usually via telephone.
Thank you. David McCulley, please.
Thanks, Kathy. Excuse me, David McCulley speaking. Just a point of clarification, Renee, for what you said, I didn't follow it all. So is the language translation for documents like notice, or is the examiner's report in the other language? Does it affect how you pick an examiner, that kind of thing?
We translate all of our template documents, because if there is a response that comes in from that complaint in that region, then we appoint an examiner that speaks that language. So we will have all the documents prepared for that examiner in that language so that they can be issued in the correct language. And we do have many determinations on our website that are in foreign languages.
And excuse me, Phil Corwin here. As we move on to administrative review, I want to suggest what we're trying to do is go through each section of the outline, ask questions relevant to that section, and if there are additional questions, I know there's at least one pending that's not keyed to one of these sections, that we reserve the last 10 minutes of the meeting, which would start in about an hour, for miscellaneous questions not related to specific topics in the outline, to make sure that everything can be asked. I hope that's acceptable. Thank you. And if there are no further questions, we can move on to administrative review.
Thank you. Slide 10 then has the administrative review questions that were asked. With respect to forum, the administrative review essentially is through the filing of the complaint. We have an electronic submission. So if, and we can scroll down to slide 11. So if you go to our website and you go on to the complaint demo, you'll see the screens that I'm talking about. But the complainant is required to supply the information. And if they don't, for each category, the complaint, the contact information, the respondent contact information, domain name, they'll get rejected, or they'll be asked to correct the information or fill it in. So the complainant contact information, the respondent contact information, the domain name, we have a system, it's automated so that we get a download from ICANN, and we use that download to eliminate the new TLDs that aren't subject to the URS. So all of the new TLDs obviously are in there with contact information. And then there's a handful, five or six, I think, that have adopted the URS. So those are also included in the information that we have. So if a complainant picks one that's not in our download or on our list, then it will be rejected for that reason. And we will get notification of that. If they try a couple of times, we'll reach out to them and kind of explain why. So we won't have any .coms. Those kinds of things don't get through. So there's no administrative reason to review the complaint for something like that. They're required to upload for each domain name three documents per the rules, the screenshots, proof of use, and evidence of the trademark. The URS procedure elements are a series of tick boxes or check boxes. That's per Rule 3B6. And then the explanatory statement. I know there's been some conversation on the respondent side with this, but the explanatory statement is captured in a text box, and the words are counted as you're typing, so you can see kind of how far you've progressed in typing your explanation. And you're not allowed to go over 500, otherwise it will ask you to remove some words and won't let you proceed with the rest of the complaint. Other legal proceedings are captured in a text box. A mutual jurisdiction is a series of check boxes. The mandatory statement is... Oh, I'm sorry, yes, 12. Thank you, Kathy. We're trying to keep each other honest here. Let's see, where did I leave off?
Mutual jurisdiction.
Okay, yep, so there's check boxes for mutual jurisdiction. Essentially, there's check boxes for everything that's not required to have some sort of text. To circle back on the abuse of complaints, I know we've had quite a bit of conversation on that. The providers share a database for that, and currently there aren't any. So, but that's something that needs to be disclosed, not by the complainant, but that's something that we would check. You know, that's not an electronic thing that a complainant probably isn't going to admit that they've had an abusive complaint finding against them. So that's something that we do check. Like I said, though, there aren't any, so there's nothing to check currently. I think I covered that. The privacy shield, as far as a case name, the respondent will be the party named in the who is when the case is filed. Even if the registrar does provide additional information, that case name doesn't change. And that's it for me, Yvette.
Thank you, Renee. So just as for forum, also for MFSD, the complaint form is a checkbox form available online. And after submission of the complaint, we carry out the administrative review within two business days as requested by the rules. First of all, we do immediately a screenshot, and we also obtain a copy of the WHOIS data independently from the documents of the complaint. The administrative review is carried out manually through a checklist, which is filled in by the case manager. And there are in the checklist several questions about the content of the complaint. So you can see on slide 13 that the first one is, does the complainant content for a new GTLD or a domain name to which URS proceeding applies? Is the complaint in English? Does the complaint include all information, indication, and declaration required by
URS procedure and URS rules. Does the complaint relate to more than one domain name, and are those domain names registered by the same holder? Has the filing fee been paid properly together with the submission of the complaint? On slide 14, you can see that there are two further questions. So has the complainant exceeded its quota of abusive complaints? And is or are the disputed domain names part of an open or active URS or UDRP case? If there are any administrative deficiencies, there is no possibility to amend the complaint by the complainant, but the complaint is dismissed by the center without prejudice to the complainant's right to file a new complaint. And according to the rules, there is no refund of the filing fees. Up till now, we had three cases of dismissal after the administrative review. And in all three cases, the complaints contended for domain names to which the URS proceeding doesn't apply, so to .com domain names. So such complaints were dismissed after the administrative review. Thank you.
Carrie?
Hi. Sure. Very much like the forum, we do have a online portal. So for a party would have to fill in some necessary information in order for the complaint to get through the system. For example, name, address, contact information of the complainant. We do ask the party who's submitting the claim to upload the WHOIS information, copies of trademark or service marks, screenshots of the disputed website information like that. So in order to get through the online portal, there is certain kind of procedures that a complaint party would have to follow. After that, our case manager, upon receiving the complaint, usually conducts a initial administrative review of the complaint for basic compliance with the procedure, the rules, and also the supplemental rules, and everything is conducted within 2 business days acknowledging receipt of the complaint. The administrative review usually is conducted in a way that is a little bit easier comparing to the way that we are conducting administrative review for UDRP cases. If a complaint is deemed non-compliant, then just as other two centers, the initial filing fee shall not be refunded. Another thing I'd like to mention is that and on slide 10, you may see that total cases dismissed due to administrative deficiencies, I put 0. But actually, on our website, you are going to see if you have the opportunity to go to the UDR, the ADNDRC website, under URS determinations, you're going to see a lot of cases that under determination status, it says case withdrawn. So those are usually cases that are submitted by parties but are not URS applicable. Usually those are cases that are concerning domain names that are not new GDLD. So they could be .com cases, .cn cases, cases like that. But in this kind of cases, usually they're already given a issued case ID. Unlike UDRP cases, you only are going to send a case number after the administrative review is conducted. So these cases, they get dismissed on our website, it's shown as case withdrawn, but they do have a case ID. So when I say non-cases have been dismissed for administrative deficiency, I have not considered those cases that are automatically deemed as URS non-applicable cases. But you can find the case data on our website under URS determination. And that does my part.
Okay, are there any more questions before we move on to the next topic?
I saw Maxim had his hand up, and I have one quick question after him. I don't know if there's others with questions.
Okay. Maxim Mazoba, for the record. The question is for ADNDRC procedure about identification of privacy proxy service used by someone and get an attempt to identify. I'm not sure that the registry operator is the party which has any kind of knowledge of this, because if registrar, for some reason, in registration fields passes information which is all just equal to symbols saying that privacy and proxy service, the registry doesn't have understanding if it was a real proxy privacy services or someone just edit text saying that it is. So I think that the party which has some knowledge is registrar. And have you had any experience in asking registries about this, or was it just designed process? Thanks.
Thanks very much for that question. I would admit that based on our experiences, because we have only administered 33 URS cases so far. So we have not had any experience in that particular regard. So that is a design process. But based on our experiences dealing with GDPR cases, usually this is, I guess this is more like additional safeguard to ensure that the respondent receives the notice. So as long as some kind of information is correct there, we're not very concerned with that in administering cases. So that is like additional safeguard for communications to be conducted in a safe manner. But it is a design process. I heard that point.
Okay, I'm going to have a quick question, and then I see Zach's hand up. Barry, right? My question, and I'll direct it to the forum, but the other providers are free to chime in if they wish. I note all the providers check if the complainant has any past findings of having brought abusive complaints. My question is, has that central database of abusive complaints been established? Is that what you're checking against, or just your own cases? And am I correct in understanding from your comments that to date there's been no finding in any URS case of abuse on the part of the complainant? Thank you. That was Phil Corwin for the record.
Sure. This is Renee. We have Forum is hosting the combined provider database. Each provider has login information to add any cases to the database. Only the providers that add information are able to edit any of that information. So another provider can't go in and take somebody out. So once they have entered something, should it happen into the database, then only that provider that entered that can make any edits to it. So we've developed a system, at least amongst the three of us now, that we will inform the other providers the minute that we also get a finding of abuse case. So we'll have a couple of different methods, but it certainly will be recorded per the rules in the database should we ever have one.
Okay, and thank you for that. On the second part of my question, was I correct in understanding that there's been no complainant to date has been found to have engaged in abuse? Is that correct?
That's correct. I will say for a short period of time, I believe that we had one that was checked on our database as abusive, but it actually wasn't. It was an error. So you may have seen that if you've ever looked. I think it was sometime in early 2016 that it was on, and when I joined as director, I reviewed that case and had it removed because it was an error.
Okay.
There was no finding of abuse in that case.
Thank you for that. I think Zach was next, and then Barry, was your hand up? So Zach and then Barry. Am I missing anyone? Okay, we'll get to that before we move on. So, Zach, go ahead.
Thank you, Zach Muscovich. Phil has asked my question, so I'll follow up on it. Are the providers integrating into their administrative review procedures a check of that repository of potential abusive cases, or are they just entering the findings of an abusive case into the database? So in other words, I want to hear whether the providers are incorporating as a standard procedure to check that database every time a complaint is submitted. Thank you.
Hi, this is...
Sorry, but we have some slides on this topic. So can we go to the slides of abusive complaints?
This is Ariel. I'm from staff. Yvette, can you let us know which slide number you want to go to?
Yes, it's 20.
Yvette, since you have a specific slide, you want to take the first crack at the question?
Thank you, Kathy. Barry Cobb for the record. And Carrie, this is for you, and maybe I just misunderstood from your discussion. You had mentioned that you don't have any cases or complaints that were submitted that failed the administrative review, but you did also mention that two cases were, or at least from my records, you had two that were withdrawn. One was for a .com name and the other for a .cn name. Can you just restate what you had mentioned? And the reason why I'm asking is the document subteam was wanting to get, I'm thankful that y'all provided the numbers for the number of complaints that had failed the admin review. So that's just one thing that we can check off from our data collection part. But can you just clarify, you said none that had, no complaints submitted had failed the admin review. But again, we do see two in our data set that were technically withdrawn. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the question. So when I was doing the presentation, I did not consider those case withdrawn cases, meaning that cases that have not been filed properly under URS, cases that have failed administrative review, because I interpret administrative review in more narrow way, meaning that cases that have actually failed administrative review by ever conducted that violated manager. But there are cases, more than two actually, that basically on our website that have shown that overthrown cases that are usually cases that have not filed properly. So if you have counted those cases on our website, that should give you the proper number. It is actually more than two.
Great, thank you.
This is Ariel from the record. For the record, and there's a question from Justin Chu. In the 17 cases dismissed, for a question for Renee, what administrative deficiencies featured the most frequently? What factors can be identified on the part of the complainants to explain these?
Hi, this is Renee. Now, I don't have in front of me exactly what each of those 17 entailed as far as the reason why they were dismissed, likely for non-payment. But I certainly can check into that and circle back if it becomes a formal question.
Okay. Any more questions on administrative review? If not, I believe our next topic is abusive complaints?
No. Examiners and appeal panels.
Examiners and appeal panels.
This is starting at page 16 at the slide presentation.
Hi, this is Renee from Forum. I'll go first, examiners and appeal panels. There were a couple different questions with respect to that topic. The first being selection. Forum's selection, preference is given to those with experience in IP, arbitration, and domain name disputes. I can say that with the current URS arbitrators or examiners we have now, most of those, I would say, I can't give a percentage, but I would say that most of them have been impaneled since the beginning, or at least within the first 6 months of the URS program. We haven't added many after probably 2014. I can't be certain, but so as far as their experience, they've had at least several years now. For assignment, it's a strict rotation with the exceptions made for availability. If an examiner is unable to do it in the quick turnaround time, they can't always be on call for such things, then we move on to the next one on the list. And as I mentioned earlier with the language issue, if we do get a response in a particular language, obviously we have to go to the next examiner on the list that speaks that language. So we're skipping over others, but then we go back to pick up where we left off with the English speaker rotation. Training, initially there were webinars and a PowerPoint that was put together to get the URS examiners up to speed. There is also an annual in-person domain name dispute training session or meeting that is offered. Yvette?
It's Yvette. We have a list of examiners, which is published with their bio at the website. The examiners are selected between professionals of multiple jurisdiction. It's because of the language requirements of the URS. So we have currently 23 examiners from the different part of the world, so with different language skills, who are experienced in cross-border intellectual property disputes, ADR proceedings, and in particularly in domain name disputes. When we are assigning a case to an examiner, the most important requirement is the language. So if the language of the response is different from English, we have to appoint an examiner who is fluent also in such language. We make a case-by-case analysis, obviously, and we adopt the principle of the rotation, and also for MFSD, it's important that the examiner is available due to the strict time frame of the proceeding. Regarding the appeal panels, there can be single member or three member panels. The panel members should be different from the examiner who decided the complaint. So far, there were no appeals handled by MFSD. We provide online training sessions, so webinars, and face-to-face training sessions are also organized regularly. Also, such events can be found at our website. They are published under news and events. Thank you.
Carrie?
Hey, so for ADR and DRC, we do have established a URS panel that's specifically dealing with URS cases. So the way that we're doing our proceedings is that for different policies, we established separate panel considering a lot of factors that I've mentioned already here by our colleagues from the forum and MFSC. The particular applicant experiences in IP, arbitration, domain name disputes, IT, this kind of areas of law. It is basically a hybrid system of application and invitation. So most of our panelists join the panel by application, but we do identify experts, specialists in the area and send our application to them. So sometimes we do outreach to experts in the field by sending invitations to them to join our panel. For when it comes to assignment, a lot of different factors are taken into consideration, including the nature of the dispute, the availability of the examiner, which is particularly important for URS proceedings, considering the rapid nature of this kind of proceeding. Identity of the parties, we give on consideration of nationality of the party. For example, if it's a American trademark owner files a complaint against a Chinese domain name holder, usually we're not going to appoint an examiner that is from the United States or from China. We try to appoint a person who that is of mutual nationality. We also consider the independence and impartiality of the examiner, their past experiences working with either parties, the relevant legal background. So as I said here, it is really a balance of factors. A lot of factors are given into consideration here when it comes to appointing a particular examiner. The same goes for appointment of the appeal panel. Here, parties also have the liberty to choose from a single-member panel or a three-member panel, and we are not going to appoint the same panelists for the initial examination or the appeal, although we have not administered any appeal cases of URS examinations. For training, we have a lot of materials readily available online, not only on the ADN-DRC websites, but also on the each four offices on websites. We also provide annual training sessions, sometimes separately by offices and sometimes jointly together. So that concludes my part.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to note at this point, I've confirmed my co-chair. We'd ask that as we proceed, we've got about another 30 minutes to complete the presentation, that the provider representatives keep their remarks fairly brief and likewise questions. With that, do we have questions regarding examiners and appeals panel? I see Lori.
And I just want to note that there are questions coming in via the chat, via our listserv, that we will get to. We're going to work very hard to reserve that 10 minutes at the end to get to questions that may be outside of the topics that we ask the providers to speak to. So I just wanted to let people know on the list that we are reading the list.
Okay. So I see Lori. Any other hands? I want to put myself in the queue. Kathy, anyone online, Ariel, with a question? Okay, so Lori, Kathy, and myself.
Go ahead, Lori. Hi, Lori Schulman for the transcript in whatever form it will be. I have a question directly to MF, SD, and then perhaps the other providers could very quickly. It's a yes or no answer. I noticed that for MFSD, there were zero appeals so far, so I just wanted to know if that was also true, what the appeal rate was from the other providers, what the numbers are. And for MFSD specifically, zero appeals, have you gotten any insight as to why there's zero appeals?
It's Yvette. So you mean which is the reason that there was no appeal until now?
Yes, correct. Thank you.
Okay. I assume that the parties didn't have any reasons to appeal. I mean, or they were satisfied with the outcome of the proceeding, or since the URS doesn't preclude subsequent GDR pre-proceeding, there is also the possibility to file a UDRP after the URS. I don't really know the reason, so we haven't been contacted neither by complainants, neither by respondents regarding the appeal proceeding.
Hi, this is...
Carrie from the ADNERC. Same as MFSC, we also have not received any appeal of our cases. The reasons could include... as Renee said, public parties are just very satisfied with the results of the examinations. Also, they have alternative remedies that could be provided to them in court of competent jurisdiction. Another reason is that from the 33 cases that we have actually handled, only 6 parties have submitted responses, specifically means that probably a lot of respondents have just not given enough consideration to the URS proceeding. The suspension, the domain name to them are probably not as serious as having the domain name transferred to the trademark owners. I guess those are some potential reasons that we have not received any appeal in our experiences.
Hi, this is Renee. We will have a topic for appeals, but I will just quickly say that Forum has had 14 appeals covering 16 domains. As far as the negative, not why certain practitioners are not appealing, I do try and ask some of the respondent attorneys, well, why, if I have the opportunity to do so casually, why didn't you appeal a particular case? And basically it comes down to a client decision where it's just maybe not worth it for them to proceed any further.
Okay, so Kathy, and then we have a remote question, then I'll ask my question last on this section. And again, hopefully brief questions and quick responses so we can get through the whole presentation. Kathy.
Okay, and I'll try to ask quickly and because I know we have a lot to go. We have a group that's looking at questions for practitioners, and one of the questions is based on some information. So let me ask you, practitioners being the attorneys who work with both the complainants and the respondents, the registrants, do practitioners know who is the examiner, and do they have the opportunity to object, say, on the basis of conflict of interest, know that's someone in my law firm, or know that's someone, you know, anything that might be a direct conflict of interest. So very, very briefly, do practitioners know up front before the decision is made who the examiner is?
This is Renee. I'll go first. They do. An email is sent out saying to both parties, indicating that an examiner has been appointed, and then it's the responsibility of the party to go to the portal to get the identity of that examiner. And at the same time, then they can check the resume on our website and get more information on that particular name.
Thank you. Yvette?
Yes, so upon appointment and acceptance of the examiner, MFSD informs the parties by email, and also the registry operator and the registrar are copied in this email, of the name of the examiner, and also the date within which, aside from exceptional circumstances, the examiner should render its determination. And any party may challenge the appointment of the examiner, provided that the determination hasn't been already published. So within the term before the determination is rendered, by submitting a request of challenge in writing to MFSD, specifying the reason, within one business day from the receipt of the communication of the appointment. So far, there was no such challenge of the examiner.
Thank you very much, Yvette. Carrie, did you want to take a second?
Sure. Just to add that in our practice, prior to the appointment of any examiner, we do ask the examiner to declare in writing to parties and the center with any potential conflict or potential impression of buyers. So we do ask the examiners to provide that declaration of impartiality and independence. As other centers, we also give the parties opportunities to challenge the examiner.
Thank you.
Although we have not received any challenge in that regard. Thanks.
Okay, Ariel.
This is Ariel from staff. There's a question from Justin Chu. Questions for all three providers. One, might there be circumstances where examiner bios are not published on your respective websites? Second, are appeal panel members always different from the examiner who decided the complaint? Would it be the same for the de novo reviews as opposed to de novo appeals, or this is subject to parties' choice?
This is Renee. Unfortunately, I have some short-term memory problems, so I always have trouble with two-part questions. The first question, I believe, was, would there be an instance where a CV or resume wouldn't be on our website? For forum, hopefully not, probably not. If we are notified if somebody is searching for a particular examiner name, then we get a notification if for some reason that resume is not available. I had maybe one instance of that just recently because I'm currently updating the resumes and I had a misload. So I was having somebody search them for me and then I was notified that we didn't have it on the website. So I quickly fixed that. So we do. And I don't know if it makes more sense now to just send this first part through to the other two. So I'll send it over to Yvette for this first part.
From our side, or the bios are published on the website. So we have 23 examiners, and all the 23 bios are on the website. Thanks.
Carrie?
It is the same here that we do have all our panelists' bio and CV published on the ADNDRC website, and we our case managers also from time to time remind our panelists to update their CV if in a particular instance that we find out someone's CV hasn't been updated for example for the past 3 years. So we sometimes do ask them to provide us with the most updated CV before we proceed with the appointment.
Okay, thank you, and this is Phil. I'll ask a quick question. This is a question just directed to the forum. I note in your presentation you say that preference is given to examiners with IP or internet law, arbitration, other domain name, dispute experience. I note that the section 2B3 of the Memorandum of Understanding entered into between ICANN and all the providers requires each examiner to ensure that each examiner has an understanding of global intellectual property issues as they relate to the internet. So can you confirm that all your examiners do in fact have internet IP background and expertise?
That's a tough question, but I would say that through the training that they're provided that they would have that. We do have in for the some of the U.S. Examiners, we have judges. So not necessarily all judges have extensive, like didn't have that as part of their practice. So, but certainly they have had experience with intellectual property cases, and through the training that they're provided with, they have an adequate basis to decide domain name disputes.
Okay, thank you for that answer, and you know, we'll have some written questions that go a little bit deeper on that. So let's move on to the next section, which is...
There was one second part of the question still pending, and I will just quickly read it again because Ariel. Are appeal panel members always different from examiner who decided the complaint? Would it be the same for de novo reviews as opposed to de novo reviews, or is this subject to the party's choice? There's new appellate examiners are appointed for appeals. Now, I think all the providers are going to maybe have some different thoughts on this, but not thoughts, but since there isn't a lot of experience with appeals. The only choice that the party would have would be a three-member panel. In an appeal, so they would give us a list of three, and I think this is covered in the appeals section that we'll be talking about later. They'll be given the list of three. We request a list of three from each party. We do our best to impanel one of the three from each party's list, and then forum appoints a chair for the URS appeals. Yvette?
Just to be short in my answer, it's the same for MFSD.
Carrie?
I do not have anything to add here.
Okay, the next section is on abusive complaints. We've already had some discussion on this, so I'd ask the providers to just focus on aspects of abusive complaints we haven't already discussed. Thank you.
I'm not certain from forum's perspective, this is Renee, that there's anything that we haven't covered. Yvette?
Yes, I mean that before I didn't reply to any questions regarding abusive complaints. So regarding the submission of the determination finding abuse. We published the determination containing such finding at our website between the determinations, and there is also a separate part of the website where there is abuse of proceedings where it should be published. As I said before, there was no abusive complaints before. When it happens, we will email such determination with the case details to the other two providers. And since we have an access to forums abusive filing database, we will also submit to such database such data. On slide 23, you can see our proceeding regarding flagging and tracking the abusive cases. So during the administrative review of the complaint, in our checklist, there is a question, has the complainant exceeded its quota of abusive complaints? And in filling in this checklist, there are some references to the URS procedure which provides what is the case of an abusive case. In such case, So filling out this checklist, we check out at the website of the forum and the website of ADN DRC if there were any abuse cases regarding such complainant, and also at our website. Thank you.
I would like to add that we do remind our examiners of the existence of the abusive complaints rule, and we ask them to provide us their finding for any abusive complaints, whether we have not had any instance of finding an abusive complaint. Another thing I would like to mention that because of the way that our online portal is designed, it is not the abusive complainant is not automatically barred from utilizing UAS. So it is a part of the administrative review process to flag that out. That's from me.
Okay, thank you for that. This is Phil. I'm going to note we're at 9:54. We have three sections left in the slide presentation: responses, determinations, and appeal. I note that there haven't been many responses or appeals. So let's try to get through these quickly because we did promise two people online we'd have a last few minutes for miscellaneous questions, and of course, we're, as noted, we're going to be sending the providers a long list of several dozen very clear written questions about this and other subjects, so this won't be the last chance we have to get responses from them. And with that, I'll turn it back over. Did you have anything to say,
Kathy? Yes. Phil, this is Kathy. If there are questions we can't get to today, can we add them to the provider's questions list and just kind of have them evaluated by the provider subteam for inclusion?
I would say sure. If they're about compliance with the rules, procedures, the MOU, sure.
Thank you. Renee, go ahead, please.
Thank you. We're on responses. For those of you not in the room, slide 25. Experiences with anecdotal feedback from respondents. Forum has had some, although we have received relatively few responses. The responses must be filed on the portal, and of course there'll be issues with anybody having to do anything electronic. But the filing itself is very similar to the complaint with a combination of text boxes and text boxes. There's a 2,500 word limitation for responses, and once it's received, the response period ends and the parties are sent an email. And this is, I included this in the slide, Kathy, because I remembered your question. So, yeah, we've answered that one already, so I'm not going to cover that. We have received correspondence from respondents where the respondent has ultimately does not file a response, so we'll get an email and saying, I don't know what's going on, and so then we'll reply and say, here's what you need to do, re-forward the email that we've sent that has the link to the portal and just try and help them out that way. Obviously, some of them are not complimentary and they're rather insultive, so for those, we try and do the same thing, but you know, we only give them so many tries to email us back and forth. That correspondence is not included in the file because that correspondence is not a response and it's not filed on our portal. And per the rules, you're only allowed to have the two documents.
That makes sense. Excuse me just a second. Ariel, I think we're on page 20, slide 26.
Great. Of course, Forum has received some feedback from both complainants and respondents on the word limitation. It's not enough. And just general complaints, as I said before, about having to use the portal. That's it for me, Yvette. Thank
you. Yes, thank you. So far, there was only one response filed in the URS disputes handled by MFSD. Such response was submitted within the 14-day response period, and there was no other respondent who contacted MFSD with any complaint or feedback. So we haven't received any questions, neither informally by email. So my response is there was no such feedback.
Carrie, and we're on slide 28.
Sure. So from the ADNDRC, I guess our experiences are quite similar with MFSD, that we have not been feedback side parties regarding their experiences with the U.S. process. We have six out of the 33 cases that respondents have actually filed a response. But we have not received their feedback since then after the proceeding is complete. That's for me.
Are there any questions on the response section?
I see no questions in the room. Are there any questions online, Ariel? And note that, as Renee said, we've covered some of these topics already with questions. Next topic, please.
The next topic is determinations. Oh.
This is Ariel from staff. There is a remote question from Justin Chu. How do the providers ensure examiners comply with URS Rule 13B? The examiner's determination shall be in writing. Provide the reasons on which it is based, indicate the date on which it was rendered, and identify the name of the examiner. Emphasis added to highlight the pertinent element.
Thanks. This is Renee. I think we will cover this with this current slide that we're on now, determinations. So for forum, we have a template for determinations through the portal. There are text boxes that are required to be filled out for the reasoning. Determinations are issued upon completion to the parties and are available on the website immediately. And all of the decisions on the website can be full text searched. I'll kick it over to Yvette right now. Yvette, do you have anything for determinations you'd like to say?
Sorry. Just as like forum, we have an online determination form to which the examiner access through its account at the platform, and only in exceptional circumstances, so if there is any technical problems with the platform, the determinations are filed by email to MFSD, and the examiners are provided with the instructions on the URS elements and defenses and how to conduct the examination of the URS proceeding by the references that can be found in the online determinations form. So there are some boxes, and for each box, there are the references to the rules and the procedure of the URS. The determination shall meet the requirements of the procedure of the rules, and regarding the length of the determination, there is not a limit. The examiner can determine itself as long as he deems appropriate. So there is no any length limit to the determination. When the determination is received by MFSD, it is transmitted to the registry, copied to the registrar with the specification of the remedy and the required actions. So if the examiner decides the suspension, the registry is requested to suspend the domain name, and if the examiner finds that the control of the domain name should be returned to the respondent, such action is requested to the registry, and it is also sent to the parties. And after that, it is published at our website.
After receiving the confirm from the registry that the suspension or returning the control to the respondent was carried out, we also do a check that in the WHOIS data such action is reflected. Thank you.
Carrie?
So for our approach to determination is very, very similar to what the other two providers. We have a template thing for examiners, and we do all have all our past decisions made available online for examiners who like to make special references to any case. Within 7 calendar days of receiving a determination, any party may actually, by written notice to the center, any other party, request the examiner to correct any computational error, any clerical or typographical errors in the decision. Such correction shall be given in writing to the parties and then become a part of the determination. Although we have not dealt with this kind of instance, the parties request a particular change in the determination. And also, the center adheres with a very strict 24-hour publication rule. So within 24 hours, upon receipt of that determination, we made the decision available to the parties, the registry, make it available on the printer's website. After receiving determination from examiners, we do read the decision and ensure that determination complies with the rule. If it is found out or checked that a particular examiner's writing of a decision has constantly fallen behind the standards of URF, then there is usually an internal reference so that a particular examiner is very, very unlikely to be appointed in determining later URF proceedings. All that information usually is not going to be made available to the public. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any questions about determinations? Okay. Phil?
Okay. That brings us to the final section on appeal, noting that the forum is the only one of the three providers that's had any appeals. There's been zero filed with the other two. I'm going to ask Renee to present quickly on that and about that. We have the other information about how the other providers have set it up. We can look at their supplemental rules. So if you could just talk about your experience with appeals and whether any of them have been successful, that would be helpful. And then we can get to questions on that and the two miscellaneous questions we have over the email. Thank you.
Hi, this is Renee. I think we've covered quite a bit of appeals. I don't know that there's anything else I can add other than there have been, I believe, successful appeals. I don't have the exact breakdown of how many were successful, but since there are 14, I don't know that it would be that difficult to figure that. I just don't recall off the top of my head as I sit here how many have been successful.
Okay, so we can get that on the record when we send the written questions. Barry?
This is Barry, just real quick, from the document subteam, in terms of data gathering, I believe that group or the larger group, when it's figured out, will be reviewing those 14 cases in a little bit more the 14 cases where an appeal was filed in more detail. Thank you.
Great. Any other questions about appeal? Great. We promised to save 10 minutes at the end. And we have questions from George and from Claudia. So I'll be reading. I'll be trying to summarize George's question, which is quite long, and it has to do with in 2009, the Minnesota Attorney General was very concerned and actually sued NAF over its consumer arbitration business involving credit cards. This is not a new question for Renee, but let me ask, and it's going to take me a second because George revised the second question. In light of that proceeding and that decision, how do NAF's business practices, I think we should say the forum's business practices, in handling domain name disputes differ from those in the consumer arbitration business which it left? And how can domain name registrants be confident that the same abuses which were alleged in consumer arbitrations are not present in its domain name dispute business? And let me switch to the revised second question, which is, in light of that question, who are the beneficial owners of the forum and, well, he said NAF of the forum, and do they have ties to the trademark industry, law firms, or anyone else that might affect the forum's neutrality? In other words, where is the statement of interest for the forum itself as an organization? And, George, I hope you don't mind my substituting forum for NAF. Thank you, Renee.
Well, I guess this question is for me. With respect to the topic of consumer arbitration, that is a political football in the United States, certainly. And for the record, Forum voluntarily ceased doing consumer arbitrations. As far as how can domain name registrants be confident that those same abuses won't happen, alleged abuses won't happen here, well, that's why we're here. That's why I'm here explaining our processes and how we do things. Everything's published as far as determinations. Examiner information is published. So I don't know how I can prove a negative that we don't have those abuses anymore. As far as the SOI for NAF, I can't tell you who the owners are. I don't know that they can tell you who I am. So I don't know how they would have any influence on how I essentially run the business or the domain name programs. It's not like owners are in my office on a daily basis. I don't even know who they are necessarily. And if there are any further questions as for their identity, I think I would definitely have to run that through staff counsel.
Okay. Thank you for that response, Renee. And as noted, it's the job of this working group to determine whether the forum and the other providers are administering the URS in compliance with the rules, procedures, and MOU, and we'll be issuing some determinations on that. I'll say, personally, I haven't seen anything to indicate that any of them are going rogue or substantially out of compliance. There may be some fine-tuning needed, but that's for the group to decide after we complete our review. I'm going to go on. Claudio DeJangi, hope I haven't mispronounced your last name, Claudio, has two questions. I'm going to ask them separately because they're on separate topics. And Claudio's first question is, if a domain is used to further a phishing attack, do their online filing systems, that is the provider's online filing systems, accept evidence of email abuse such as the email header? So that's Claudio's first question, and I'll ask for brief responses from the providers in regard to that.
The evidence that Forum would consider would be the information that is able to be attached to the complaint. I guess that's all I can say for that.
And that type of evidence would be a permissible attachment as a follow-up?
That wouldn't be for us to decide. That would be for the examiner to decide. They could attach anything they wanted, but the examiner would decide if it falls within the categories.
Comments from the other providers on that question? Brief comments. Thank you.
If it's attachable to the complaint, it can be accepted as proof. Thank you.
I agree with other two providers' comments, and I do not think I have anything to add on this particular point. Thanks for that.
Okay, so to summarize those answers, all the providers have said that that type of evidence could be attached to the complaint, and the relevance would be determined by the examiner. Claudio's second question was, if this working group decides to recommend that the URS become a consensus policy applicable to legacy domains? Are the providers, can they easily scale their services, or would they anticipate any challenges in doing so? I guess that presumes that there'd be a significant number of filings against domains at legacy TLDs if URS became an available dispute resolution policy for those TLDs. So we'll start with Renee on that.
I think the system itself would be easily scalable. I think we would have to certainly consider if we'd want to undertake that, if it were applicable to legacy domains, with the fee structure that is provided. You know, I'll be honest that we're certainly not making any money off of the URS cases. So, and not that that's, you know, the primary concern. What we were trying to do is give our filers a complete package of options. So I guess that's to be determined at a later date.
Okay, and responses from MFSD and then from the Asian Dispute Resolution Center.
MFSDs have no technical problems to receive complaints also for other type of domain names different from new JTLDs if URS becomes a consensus policy. So there is no such technical issue. Thank you.
So from the ADN-DRC side, I definitely agree that there's not much technical difficulty for us to extend the current URS system to legacy domains. I would say that we welcome such extension at the ADN-DRC because with our current case, I think if the working group agreed to extend URS to make it applicable for legacy domains, that would actually help us to expand our services provided under the URS. So that is our answer to that question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for those responses. We're about to wrap up, but I see Barry Cobb wants to intervene with a statement. And is there another? So, Barry, go ahead.
Thank you, Phil. Barry Cobb. Just real quick, there were two cases filed with Forum, which is for .pro, which is kind of a legacy TLD. One, I think the result of the claim was denied because I think it was paired with another domain, and the other case was suspended with a default suspension. So there's a hint of legacy out there, but just to tack on to what Claudio was asking, thank you.
Thank you, Barry. And just to add to what Barry's statement, of course, URS is available at some legacy TLDs which have accepted URS in negotiations for renewal of their registry agreements, but it's not yet a requirement for all legacy TLDs. With that, we're 1 minute over. I think it's been a very productive session. We thank all three providers for being with us. As noted, we got the high points today. We're going to be sending detailed written questions, and we'll be getting responses on those for the record. And with that, I'm going to see if my co-chair has any concluding statement.
I'd like to thank the community for a marathon set of sessions, four sessions during this meeting. Thank the working group, and I'd like to thank the community for joining us today. And just to share that this is an example of kind of the deep dive we try to do into data, and especially thank the providers who, on very little time, put together all these slides and came to join us. So thanks to everyone. Safe travels home, and we'll see you online. Our next meeting is...
This is Sarah Liang from staff. Next meeting is Wednesday, 28th of March, 16 UTC.
Thank you very much. Take care, everyone. Safe travels home.